Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. If you'd like to look at the schedule, listen to some past interviews, sign up for our podcast, any and all of that, plus more information about programming on WILL, available at our website, which is WILL, or WILL, if you like, will.illinois.edu. We're pleased to have back here on the program, once again, Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here on the program, and we talk about language, about the English language, about how it changes, about how it is used, sometimes how it is misused. And we always have a good time when he's here.
Always have a good time.
It's true. You do always have a good time.
Because you represent will and I represent won't.
And between
that
the
other
two
radio
of us,
station.
What is there? What W-O-N-T. Yeah, yes. Believe me. Sometimes, a lot of times around here, that's it is more like won't. Anyway, he's here occasionally, and we tell people, if you have grammar questions, call, and he'll tell you what he thinks. If you would like to complain about misuse, you can call.
The doctor is in.
And he'll tell you what he thinks. The Dr. Grammar, sometimes, it's one of his aliases. He's authored a number of books about language issues. He has a blog that you might want to take a look at if you're interested in language. It's The Web of Language. Just put that into your browser and you'll find it. And you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm just looking at a story that came out just recently from the News Bureau that mentioned you in the blog. And one of the interesting things in here, I think you make this comment that you think maybe that more people have read your blog postings than have read any of the
actual scholarly publications that I spent the last 30 years laboring over intensely.
Whereas
the blogs I write in an afternoon and throw out into cyberspace, and all of a sudden people want to read it.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
Of course, it's free.
Well, that could yes, be. There's that.
But if I were handing out copies of those essays on a street corner,
you think you could?
People would take a look at it and they say that it's not an ad for adult entertainment or discount coupons at a local store. They'd walk away. You know, it's like I have this thing I do in class where, you know, if I were giving out $10 bills on the street corner, you know, what would people would they? You know, if I were giving out,
they'd think either something was wrong with you
poems,
or something wrong with the money.
If I were giving out poems on a street corner,
would you think people would?
Either they would politely take it and throw it in the wastebasket, you know, 20 steps down the street, or, you know, it's just,
I don't know. I think
weird.
If you were standing there handing out money, this would be viewed with great suspicion.
Great suspicion.
And probably the authorities would
I'd be arrested as some kind of subversive.
Okay, buddy. All right. Well, we got some callers here. Shall we talk with folks?
Let's talk with people. Right, let's go to the phones.
Hey, that's my line.
Oh.
Let's go to the phones. Line number one is in Champaign.
You do that line very well.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, line one. Hi.
Here's my question.
Yes.
We'll say things like, she is a friend of mine.
Yes.
But Europeans will say, she's a friend of me. Like, it's almost like a double possessive that we use.
Of mine, yeah. Okay.
So what's the scoop on that?
She is mine friend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of early Middle Englishy, old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. What's the scoop on that? We can't say she's a friend of me. Why not? Because we would say she's my friend, or she is a friend of, and the disjunctive form of the personal pronoun in this case is mine.
Okay.
And the second person would be thine.
All right.
But
sense.
in the plural, it'd be yours, not your.
Indeed. Well, thanks a lot. I cleared it up.
Not right. Really. I mean, it's just an idiom of English, really, though, that we choose to do it that way.
Other languages, do they do it differently?
And mes amis, one of my friends, can you say un ami à moi? I mean, there is a disjunctive in French as well. À moi, you know, of mine would be the English translation.
Yeah.
But it literally in French would mean of to me, or something like that.
That somehow doesn't sound right, but we'd have to have some.
I mean, there are other amois that you would. Oh.
Okay, well, let's talk next with someone in Belgium. Line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Not to manipulate your programs, but
oh, go right ahead.
That's fine.
My dear wife just retired from being a fifth grade teacher for 35 years, and she spent all those 35 years correcting grammar of children.
I hope there were at least different children.
Pardon me?
Different children along the way.
Yeah, they weren't
not
the same,
child over and over again for 35 years. It gets
well,
tiresome.
Maybe some of them were.
Yeah.
But no, and she's gone through have, went, have, gone
mm-hmm.
for this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take before finally we decide to say, it's not worth the effort anymore?
Well, that's a very good question, really, because there is this sort of tension between the sort of notions of what's correct to use and what's standard to use and the language that people tend to use when they're not under the microscope or the magnifying glass, the informal, casual, non-standard speech. And I don't think we're going to give up anytime soon in terms of insisting on standards, but I don't think we're going to have any more luck in getting those standards adhered to by fifth graders or graduate students or professionals in the workforce either. I mean, it's just this ongoing spiral of language charting its own course and people trying to chart that course for it.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Ken,
it pays the bills for me, but a lot of people find it to be frustrating mm-hmm. and either worry about, well, why don't people just learn the right way to do it, or as the caller suggested, maybe it's time to give up entirely. But I don't think that's either of those is going to happen.
Is this kind of change predictable, or maybe
only in the sense that you know something's
going to
change.
The
direction of change isn't particularly predictable. Although, if you see trends going on, for example, there's something that linguists are calling the northern cities shift. It is a raising of short vowels in words that's taking place in cities in the northern U.S. basically from around, I don't know, at least Buffalo, perhaps even a little further east, stretching westward, trekking like I-80 or something through Minneapolis, including Chicago and Cleveland and stuff like that, stretching down a little bit below, you know, that I-80 latitude, but not a whole lot. And among people who are born and lived their entire lives in the region and generally not affecting African-American speech, but non-African-American speech. So things like a word like bus being pronounced boss, almost like you know, the person who employs you, boss.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it sounds very strange to people who don't use that intonation, that kind of pronunciation, but we have tapes of it. There's a project being conducted out of the University of Pennsylvania tracking this and suggesting that it is this vowel raising is going to continue. I mean, has been on the increase over the last 10 years or so. And so in that sense of predicting a sound change, that it seems to be ongoing and is going to be continuing. Where it will stop, we don't know. It is potentially the cause of some confusion, because as words change their pronunciation, they sound like other words and people can get confused, and context can usually disambiguate and tell you what it really means, but sometimes it can't. And so, you know, that's all I can tell you about that.
All right. Dennis Barron is the guest. He's a professor of English here at the University of Illinois. Occasionally he's on the program. We talk about language.
I try not to raise my vowels.
It's a good thing because...
Because...
We need to maintain
standards.
The bus and the boss.
Right. Standards as opposed to standards.
Standards.
Which would be a raising.
That up in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got to go with that grudge.
Yes.
Line number one is next. Champagne. Hello.
You sound like, I guess the, this isn't the reason I call, but because of your discussion. In terms of the promoting of the profession of English majors, I don't know. I don't know whether you've done that well.
You know. you don't think he's selling the business? Of
I'm not selling the business. I'm not making it an attractive prospect for.
Yeah, right.
Okay. We're overwhelmed with English majors.
Okay.
So if we have some reduction in force, as the euphemism for that would be, it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, what's the guy up in Minnesota, the one that always gives the things about English majors a hard time?
Oh, Garrison. Garrison Keillor.
Yes, yes. So, former English major
Well,
himself,
he's the guy that, though, he has the bit where he does the lives of the English majors where English it actually majors. Turns out that being an English major, it works to their good.
Yes,
so,
yes.
But, of course, it's...
We have countervailing forces there. Actually, the reason I called was the history of the Four Horses of the Apocalypse. Would you know that one?
No.
No?
No. Does that have something to do with language?
Well, in a way, I guess.
You have to go to Wikipedia, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I've lost the faith now. Thank you.
Oh, no.
I never had it, but, you know.
It could be another one of the signs we're near the end.
We're near the end.
Losing the faith.
We're losing
the faith in Dennis.
Yeah.
We're speechless. We're gone.
Weren't they football players? Or
the Four Horsemen?
Yeah. No, the horses themselves.
Does that come out of a Marx Brothers movie or something?
Marx Brothers movie, yeah. A Day at the Races, A Day at the... Uh-huh. A Day of the Apocalypse.
The one they didn't make, it's still, you know. That's the lost script.
The lost script.
No one knows what happened to it.
Yeah, the fifth Marx brother.
Let's talk again with another caller here. Line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've heard on the news lately and politicians, and they seem to me to be confusing historic and historical.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain the difference to me, please?
No.
Is there really a difference between historic and historical?
I don't know. Historical. We tend to reserve historic is more common. Okay, historical is probably a little more rare and a little more formal sounding. And so, are you saying that people are using historical when they
well,
should
I hear
be using
them used interchangeably? And
yeah.
So I don't know. So you can do that. They're the same thing.
Historical. I mean, they mean slightly different things, okay? So historical event is one that actually happened, that's documentable, right? A historical, as opposed to a mythological, whereas historic means of great importance, watershed, in having some kind of, this is historic.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a historic putt that he's going to make now, and he's addressing the ball. You know, that sort of. That's the sort of semantic. I mean, they're both adjectives in that sense. And so they can be plugged in wherever a good adjective can be plugged in. Yeah, I think the difference is substituting historical, meaning documentable, for when you actually mean something that's of great importance.
Well, okay.
Or vice versa.
Well, thank you.
So it's an historical fact George Washington was the first president. It's an historic event that Barack Obama is the nominee of the Democratic Party.
Presumptive, I believe, is the word that
a
lot of the
correct, commentators... To be perfectly correct, he is indeed the presumptive nominee.
Or what was the other word they used on NPR this morning? It wasn't presumptive. I think they're getting tired of presumptive already. It sounds a little bit like, you know, the British royal family.
But are we saying then that there's really no difference between the two other than...
I think there's a slight semantic difference in the fact that they both have history as their root leads in, you know, to potential interchanges.
All right.
Intersubstitutability.
We have no calls at the moment.
Okay, let's talk about my favorite subject of the day, which was the story that was in the Times yesterday about the graduation in a high school in Terrebonne Parish in Louisiana, outside New Orleans, and the co-valedictorians were a pair of Vietnamese cousins, Huy Vo and Cindy Vo. And I believe Cindy, in her valedictory address, used a sentence in Vietnamese to honor her parents. And the sentence she then translated as something to do with be your own person. You know, one of these little moral things, mm-hmm. that bits of advice that you associate with valedictory addresses. And Huy, the cousin, spoke a little bit longer in Vietnamese and did not translate. But again, it was something, I think, honoring the sacrifices her parents as immigrants made to you know, make sure that the two kids succeeded in school and gave them every opportunity, things like that. And the school board of Terrebonne Parish, a number of members of the school board, when they heard these words in Vietnamese, decided to propose a policy that from henceforth and forevermore, graduation speeches should be only in English. Terrebonne, good earth, literally, from the French. Louisiana having been from the start a multilingual area full of Native Americans, French speakers, and English speakers, and with a significant number of Spanish speakers who had made their way from Florida as well. Interesting kind of thing. And my question to them is, should they even consider changing valedictory address to the more English bye-bye speech? Because valediction is a farewell.
No Latin.
Words of farewell in
no
Latin.
No Latin.
Yes. No Latin either. I checked, by the way, the Louisiana state motto is in English.
This, I suppose, given how often this particular issue has come up, I suppose it shouldn't really be surprising that someone still should be making an issue of, of English.
Right.
It just, not too long ago, I was talking to somebody here about the issue of assimilation. And we talked about assimilation and what that means and different kinds of assimilation. And it seems like the number one thing that gets people most exercised continues to be newcomers' acquisition of English.
Right. And here are two newcomers who apparently made it to the head of their high school graduating class. Seniors, which is another Latin slash French word. I suppose we should call them fourth years instead. Who apparently have fairly good English fluency. And they're, you know, they're being singled out as, you know, representatives of a bilingualism that is to be frowned on, discouraged.
Did this,
if not formally forbidden.
And did the story give an indication of what the community thought about this proposal of the school board? Whether they thought that was a good idea, or whether they thought that was
no, it just surfaced. It's a story to follow. Actually, the superintendent of schools is quite skeptical about this proposal, but as he said in the story, and his name is something Richard, I think a majority of the school board is of French ancestry in Terrebonne Parish. And there, you know, there was a time, I think, back in the 1950s when students in schools were punished for speaking French in Louisiana. And, you know, the position of French in Louisiana is ambiguous because obviously it's a big tourist attraction.
Do you think that this, one way or another, the attempts to compel people to, if not speak and learn English, to use it in official situations is something that in the United States we're just going to keep going, or is there some point you think that sort of dies out?
There's a certain amount of momentum that's been gathering in this, and I think the interesting thing is how it has trickled down to these like individual sites, like a school. There's a school in a parochial school in Wichita, Kansas, that banned the use of foreign languages at school. Period. It's a K-8 or pre-K-8 school in Wichita, and they don't teach foreign languages.
So that was going to be my question. What that means that they also don't teach
foreign
languages?
They don't teach foreign
So you can't
languages.
Speak it in the hallways, but also you're not competing in the classroom.
Not in a classroom.
Formal instructional
right.
way.
And you can't speak it on the playground or on the school bus. I mean, they have a significant number of kids from immigrant families, Spanish speakers, Vietnamese speakers, and so on. But I think that the statistics show that almost all the kids in the school are at least bilingual, and many of the kids from ethnic families are monolingual English speakers. So it's a curious thing. I mean, that you've got workplaces that ban the use of foreign language. You've got cities and towns that want to make English their official language. Like, you know, why does a tiny town in Maryland or in New Jersey need to have an official language? Many of these places have no significant immigrant population either. And it's just sort of a symbolic, building an electric fence around the town.
Well, I think that some of the justification for the workplace thing is that someone has made the argument that it's divisive.
It's divisive.
It divides people into different...
Because when you hear somebody speaking a language that you don't understand, you know in your heart of hearts that they're talking about you and they're making fun of you. And, you know, I talk about this with my students and they say, those who are bilingual, they say, well, you know, sometimes they're right. But people whispering... in the same language, the language that you understand,
could also be
making fun of you. And very often, you know, we make fun of our teachers, we make fun of our employers, we make fun of the other employees, our coworkers, our fellow students. That's sort of what people do.
Well, I don't.
But there's this sort of paranoia that if it's in a language I can't understand, it must be about me, and it can't be good.
I like the idea of having the kids on the playground speaking all these languages. Let them teach each other their languages. Let them have a good time with
them. It's one of the sites where students who don't speak English acquire it very quickly from English-speaking schoolmates.
Oh, so you think that if
you ban it, it makes it... people become more self-conscious. And you know, it could... even impose an impediment to learning because, you know, once you ban something, people say, well, you know, you don't want me around here. I mean, that's the underlying message that they read.
Our guest this morning in this hour, Focus 580, is Dennis Barron. He's a professor of English at the University of Illinois. He has written a lot on language issues like this one in particular. He has a blog, The Web of Language, you might take a look at if you're interested in sampling some of his thoughts about current
I mean, I once wrote an essay in the Washington Post suggesting that if you really wanted to get people to speak English, you shouldn't make it official. You should ban it.
That's the sure way to get people to say, you can't do this. Don't do this.
Don't do it. And then they'll want to know what are they keeping me from?
What's so dangerous about it? 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Got some callers here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
How about another foreign language, British English?
Ah, yes.
And, you know, certainly I've never quite understood how they drop article the in stories saying someone went in hospital.
Well, and maybe it's that we added it.
Why they don't drop other articles like A or N, or maybe they do, and I'm just unaware of it.
Doctor will see you now.
Yeah.
It's a difference. This
is
true.
Is there a rule?
Yeah, the rule is that things change. Things are different. There isn't one English. There are many. And the question of who owns English then becomes interesting because different groups seem to want to stake out ownership positions in terms of what's right and what's weird.
When the British teachers deal with this, how do they deal with it for their students?
I'm not sure really what you mean by that. They have different standards of what's acceptable and correct and what to aim for than Americans do and English speakers in other countries around the world also have local standards. That's one of the interesting things about English is the existence of multiple sets of standards. Even within the United States, there are multiple sets of standards regionally for things like pronunciation and vocabulary choice.
Well, this is BBC doing it. So mm-hmm. I would have thought that was the standard. Well, that was standard, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of variation within British English. I mean, despite the fact that they have what at least seem to Americans as kind of more rigid sets of standards and more correct pronunciation, the sort of, you know, thing you associate with the Royal Shakespeare Company and the BBC and stuff like that. There's plenty of regional variation that bubbles to the surface, you know, which we saw when the Beatles became popular and all of a sudden, you know, Liverpudlian English, the English of Liverpool, comes onto Americans' radar.
Well, I've heard on NPR shows American commentators or reporters dropping the article also.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's a certain amount of
England or listening to BBC longer than I have, I guess.
If you know, a lot of Americans look to British English as some kind of prestige variety, and so that sort of imitation.
Is there any time when they do use the?
Sure. The English use the definite article all over the place. They just don't quite use it the same way idiomatically that Americans have.
Okay.
It's just spun in slightly different directions.
That's some answer. Thank you, Dr.
Thank
B.
you. And has that difference, that is, the British to say someone was in hospital and in the United States we would say they were in the hospital, has that difference always is?
I don't know what the history of that is. I don't know how recent the split is. I mean, that's something you could check in the Oxford English Dictionary or something like that. It's one of these sort of differences between British and American English that Americans point out all the time, you know, two great nations separated by a common language. Elevators versus lifts, apartments versus flats, rubbers versus erasers.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Line number 2 is next. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is this I? Okay, hey, I have a question for the doctor.
Yes, yes.
It regards Walmart. Okay, so I was at Walmart the other day.
Ah, well, there you go. That was your first mistake.
And my brother talked to me about this as well. We're kind of in debate about, I guess, what's correct and what's not correct, and maybe this is just one of those things that's changing, or maybe this is just how it is down south.
Don't forget that at Walmart they use discount English.
Yeah, I noticed. So, all right, so the express lane, right? It says 20 items or less. Now, I'm pretty sure in school that Miss Smith in eighth grade really drilled it into our heads that if you can count it, you use fewer, and if you have an uncountable thing, it should be less.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, more for my brother than for me.
Right, because you know the answer, and you're trying
to
beat your brother
fewer,
over the head with it, right?
Yeah.
So here's the deal. For anybody who says, is this I in... as you did when you got on the line, then yes, it's fewer. But for the rest of us who say,
Is this me?
It's less. So here's the story that I tell about this.
Did I really say that?
Yeah. Long time ago, I've been in this town a long time. If you think back to when on Green Street, what is now CVS, which used to be Osco, which once was Jewel, and before that was Eisner's. There was a grocery store there. And the story is that, you know, only in an academic community would something like this happen. the express lane. I was in there one day, and I noticed that the express line with the 20 or 10 items or less or whatever it was, because I think we have express lane inflation now. I think it was only 10 items in those days. The shopping carts were smaller, too, and life was proceeded
so
at
much,
a much slower
so much
pace.
Simpler then,
simpler.
Yes.
And somebody had climbed up onto the belt and using a magic marker, crossed off less and scrawled in fewer.
Well, good for that.
And I'm guessing it was some outraged
English
professor or graduate student who was working part-time at the grocery store to make ends meet, climbed up on the belt and corrected that. But that, I thought that was cute. Yeah, technically you're right, but nobody observes that distinction.
Well, I kind of figured it was just something that's sort of changed, and it's just the way it's going to be in the future here.
Yeah, well, but, you know, it's up to you to fight the good fight and to, you know, twit your brother about his misuse of it. But don't expect Walmart to fall in line.
Oh, I knew that I could
here.
Yes, if you get up there with a magic marker at Walmart, they're just going to call.
Because, as you know, less has fewer letters than fewer. And so they probably figured they're saving money.
Well, they probably are. They got, what, 20 billion stores?
And if they had to change all those signs, they'd have to raise prices to compensate. They'd pass that cost along to you.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Let us continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign and on line number 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
So you were talking a few minutes ago about language policing.
Yes.
And I was wondering what your take on it is in the sense of whether it's more of a race and class issue.
It often is, yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because, on the one end, you see in lots of middle schools and high schools now a lot of stress towards learning, Chinese and Japanese because they're better for international business.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want employees to be speaking Spanish, and we don't like African-American English.
We probably don't want employees to be speaking Japanese or Chinese because they might be talking about us, too. We don't mind if they're speaking it to clients, perhaps, or visiting delegations of Chinese or Japanese business folks. But to just speak it around the office tends to be viewed as divisive. Yeah, and it's definitely a race, class, sometimes even gender thing.
Yeah.
And what we have done historically in the United States in terms of dealing with the languages that immigrants bring to the U.S. Don't forget that English is an immigrant language, not only in the United States, but in the British Isles. And if we think of it with that perspective, it gives you a sort of different take on, you know, what happens when a language crosses a geographical boundary from one place to another. English came from the continent when Anglo-Saxons and Jutes migrated and possibly invaded, we don't know which it was, a combination of both, the British Isles in the 5th century. So displacing the native Celtic speakers or assimilating them. English, you know, is an immigrant language, obviously, in the United States because it was imported from England. So, but historically, what the United States has done culturally with immigrant languages is to do everything in its power to encourage immigrants to lose that first language, not just acquire English, but lose their L1, their original language, their mother tongue. And then we turn around after we've stripped them of their native speech and say, well, now that you're in high school, you got to take a foreign language. And that's going to be one of the languages that we have decided is worth learning. You know, and those have been historically languages, starting with the classics like Latin and Greek. Not so much now, obviously. French and German. Then more recently, Russian. Then Spanish. And now, Chinese and Japanese. So, which languages are up on the charts and which are down on the charts also varies with you know, historical change. So, yeah, get rid of your language, and then we'll teach you another one that you will learn only imperfectly because we're really not so good at foreign language instruction. And rather than using your talent and developing it and having you be effectively bilingual and allowing you to use that first language in situations where it is not only personally useful for you in terms of family and culture, but, you know, internationally useful in terms of the gross domestic product.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for the comment.
I wasn't sure if you were done.
Yes. Well, no. Unless you wanted to follow up.
Well,
The lecture.
Sorry?
I'm sorry about the lecture.
It's okay. I get it a lot.
That's what we have professors on this program for.
Yes.
To give lectures.
Yes.
It helps when the professor is also one of your parents.
Oh, okay.
But...
Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. And has it generally always been the case that people, it seems that it takes about two generations for newcomers to completely lose
the L1. The typical model has been first generation monolingual L1 speakers with, you know, acquiring perhaps a smattering of English, second generation, kids born here, bilingual, speaking the language of their parents and grandparents, as well as English. Third generation, monolingual English speakers, unable to converse with their bilingual parents in the L1 or with the grandparents in their original language. There are suggestions that in immigration patterns today, in many cases, we are skipping the bilingual generation and going straight from a generation of parents who speak only the immigrant language to children who speak only English. They may have a smattering of words in that parent's language. and this is true for Spanish speakers. Mm-hmm. Significantly, because in one way, one of the issues with Hispanic immigration that critics of it always bring up is that there's a lot of going back and forth, and there's a lot of renewal of the Spanish-speaking community in terms of incoming immigration. And so there is certainly a significant amount of bilingualism that's necessary to maintain that continuing renewal of the community and a continued contact with, you know, going back home to visit relatives and spending significant amounts of time in two different places. But there's also a large subset of kids who are not speaking Spanish, are only speaking English, are not speaking Chinese, are only speaking English, and not speaking Hindi or Urdu, and only speaking English. So this is possibly a shift, a hastening of assimilation.
So if that process is being, I think that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. If this process is being accelerated, why is that happening? I'm sure some people would say that's, you know, if you're into the English only thing,
It's not externally imposed. It's sort of a self-directed kind of thing. There's a sense that, you know. Here we are in English-speaking land, and to make it, to be popular, to be successful, to be whatever you know, to follow what you want to do, English is the way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's very.
So I mean, you know, without requiring official English of people,
it's happening.
It's happening. England and the U.S. do not have national official language legislation. England and the U.S. are, you know, extremely successful at converting immigrants to speaking English without, you know, formal requirements. Mm. It just happens. Countries with official language laws, on the other hand, those laws tend to be very defensive and tend to be less effective in terms of converting people from one language to another. The laws tend to be put in place as defensive measures because there's a perception that the language is endangered. Now, the people who want to make English official because they fear we are being swamped in the United States or in England, too, because that's an issue in England, too, by people who don't speak English, and that someday, you know, English will be under attack at home. It's just not happening. It's an illusion that English is in danger.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Yes. Dennis Barron is here with us. He's professor of English, University of Illinois. We talk about language from time to time, and questions welcome, grammar questions welcome, any and all of this kind of thing. You can give us a call.
It is I.
It is he. Is that correct? Line one is next, and that's Champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a comment, a rant, and a question.
Okay.
The comment is the earlier discussion about how speaking a foreign language in the workplace is divisive. It just reminds me of the, you've probably heard the expression, you don't have to be paranoid to know they're out to get you.
Yes. When they're really out to get you,
yep,
it's not
really
paranoid.
You,
they are, I mean, and they are. You know, like, just look around. They are
there
out
are.
To get us. Whoever we are, whoever they are, you know, it's a lose-lose situation.
I know they're out to get me, man.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Now the rant.
It's a mild rant.
Okay.
There was a discussion earlier, and in the previous hour, there was all this discussion about historic things, which in popular usage, it seems to me, has become synonymous or means old anymore.
Okay.
And not in, like, there's referring to historic Lincoln Hall. Well, what historic thing happened there? It's an old, nice building. I used to be a matriculant at the U of I and suffered through
historic
many a German
in the sense
class in there, as a matter of fact. And
the plaster is crumbling, the paint is peeling off the walls,
versus,
the roof leaks. You know,
I mean,
that's
you see,
historic.
You see signs all over the place, you know, historic Urbana. Well,
yes, historic Urbana.
No, that's what's the historic? The fields around Gettysburg are historic. You know, they have a significance. So,
yeah, nothing ever happened in Urbana.
Right. I mean, just name the thing that happened. You know, so
right. Well,
but my that's my rant. So much for my rant.
Okay. We'll hear from the Urbana Historical Association.
Oh, I don't
sure.
care. I know they're out to get me, so it doesn't matter. now, somewhere along the way, I must be so very narcissistic. I didn't notice this happening up until just a few years ago, and perhaps you could comment on this. I hear it all the time in the media and in common usage and so on and so forth. The expression "got," meaning the past tense to be, and I always thought, you know, only hillbillies spoke like that when I was a wee child, and we were taught, you know. Someone got killed, and someone was killed.
Mm-hmm. The get passive has been part of sort of normal English usage for a long, long time.
Well, like I said, I was wrapped up in myself, so I guess I didn't notice. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily, a hillbilly usage. I grew up with get passives in New York City where hillbillies were just on TV.
All right, so it gets your imprimatur.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's a historic form in the sense that it goes way back. I mean, I don't know how way back, whether it's 20th century or before that, but certainly it's been around as one of the options for the passive for quite a while.
All right.
One of the passive auxiliaries.
All right. If you have a question, you might try to call, but the lines are full, and we may not have time. 333-9455, toll free.
And if we don't answer your calls because we're out to get you, we have singled you out for disfavor.
Yes, we know who you are.
We know who you are.
We know where you
and,
live.
You know, your paranoid fears are absolutely justified.
Let's talk with someone also in Champaign, line number two.
Now, Champagne is a place where history has taken place, right?
Line number two?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, a couple of comments. One is English, obviously, is the English language is changing. American English is changing. But I'm wondering what you have to say about what is really an acceptable standard of pronunciation, for example, like announcers on the radio or TV or just in common everyday language. For example, the letter T is often made a D, and the P is often made a B, and so on, those Fortis and Lennis kinds of things. It's going to change, and I'm wondering if you have a somewhat of a guiding principle for people to, like announcers on the radio or TV, to uphold certain standards. For example, here in Champaign County, they say Champaign County really pretty often, you know, and it's a nice picture to see a county out there for counties and uncharted waters, and how about this one? Utterly for utterly, and that's a good one, but that sort of thing. What is your idea about this sort of thing? Is there a place for formal language and then something that's not so formal, you know, like between us?
Yes. Well, here's what happens with that voicing of the T in particular. I remember when I took in high school Latin, and our Latin teacher meticulously forced us to pronounce that T unvoiced. Latin, Latin. You know, we had to go, and we were probably graded on that, as we were on our amo, amas, ama, and so on. And that sort of careful speech emphasis on the proper pronunciation. What happens is that in a voiced environment between two vowels, an unvoiced consonant like a t tends to be voiced because the vowels, all vowels are voiced. So a, I, the vowels in Latin, it's very easy, particularly in rapid speech, to pronounce the consonant that comes between the vowels with voicing. Voicing simply means you're vibrating your vocal cords when you say the consonant. The t and the d sounds are essentially the same. The only difference is that you're vibrating your vocal cords, the main phonetic difference. So Latin is the way most of us said it because we were speaking casually and, you know, when we were being hyper correct and on stage in class, we would punch that T sound, that devoicing it. But the normal structure in English is to voice that consonant. So it's kind of a tension between the formal pronunciation and the informal one. Here's another example that is similar but doesn't involve voicing. The difference between saying O-F-T-E-N, pronouncing it often and often. I remember attending a talk once and the speaker was reading the words, and every time he came to the O-F-T-E-N, he said often. And then during the question and answer period, he sat on the edge of the desk, put his papers down, and every time someone asked him something, he said, often. So it's the difference between careful and formal speech and relaxed informal speech as well that cues these differences in pronunciation.
Well, I guess what I'm getting around to, I understand that sort of thing. What I'm getting around to, I'm wondering at a university, for example, whether we should teach both things and just say that language does change and you may use it in whatever circumstance you feel is the most, the way you are, I guess.
Well, essentially what I'm doing is describing the different variants that occur and trying to figure out what the differences are and what motivates one or another in a given context. We are not issuing instructions for announcers, which is something that the media used to do. I don't know if they do as much anymore in terms of that. There are recommended pronunciations for foreign names, names of countries, certain sorts of things that come up in the news that that they send out reminders to people who are speaking them to tell you, you know, one day everybody was saying Peking and the next day they were saying Beijing, those sorts of things that they do. But in the early days of radio, certainly there was a lot of regulation of what announcers said. There were all sorts of manuals that were put out.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering if there was a standard you felt that radio announcers, for example, should have, such as especially at an educational institution like the University of Illinois and WILL Radio,
yeah,
for example.
The simple answer to that is no.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, and is it really is it clear what is a regional, say, a matter of dialect,
yeah,
and what is just lazy articulation?
Well, I mean, there are multiple factors involved there. And what used to be the case, too, in the media was that there was a requirement for a standard pronunciation nationally, both on the BBC and on the American radio networks. And that has relaxed over the last 50 years to the point where local, regional variants are much more acceptable. You would never hear on the BBC anyone with an Irish accent or a Northern British accent and reading the news.
Yeah.
And now you do.
Now you do. Yeah.
And American regional variation is similarly relaxed. Compare if you can get tapes of announcers from the radio in the 1930s and 40s to what announcers say today.
We must stop there.
Yes.
If you're interested in reading some of Dennis's writing about language, look at his blog, The Web of Language, or some of his other works in print at the bookstore or library near you.
Yes.
Dennis Barron is a professor of English here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Occasionally he's here and we talk about language. Thanks very much.
Great to be here.